A Texas businessman wasn't content when federal charges against him were dismissed, thrown out of court, really. He spent 25 years since trying to get back at prosecutors and Postal Service inspectors. And now he's getting his day in court. To explain the implications of the strange case of William Moore Jr., in this week's Legal Loop, we turn to Steve Ryan. He's an experienced litigator and head of the government strategies practice at McDermott, Will & Emery. Steve, good morning.
Good morning, Tom, and happy 4th.
And to you, too. So give us a little background on this case. It was actually thrown out of court in 1989?
Well, it's fascinating. It was a criminal indictment brought against Mr. Moore, and the case went to trial, and at the end of the government's case, the judge threw out the case. He just said no reasonable jury could find a crime here. It's one of the great victories for a defense when the government's case is essentially dismissed before they even have to put on the defense case. And that's what happened. And most people in that circumstance go have a glass of Merlot, are grateful they're not wearing an orange jumpsuit, and go on with their lives. But Mr. Moore basically came back and sued the prosecutor and the investigative agents of the Postal Inspectors Group who had prosecuted his case and investigated his case, alleging that his constitutional First Amendment rights had been harmed.
Because he had mounted, I guess, a publicity campaign against the Postal Service for choosing someone, another company, for optical recognition equipment, which was the name of his company, instead of the American-made machine that he was selling.
Well, it's a fascinating case because it shows that Mr. Moore and his company actually participated in some ways in trying to campaign for someone who ultimately became the Postmaster General, hoping that that would then enhance their contractual issues. And that is the First Amendment issue that's in the case.
All right. So it was thrown out of court. So the case was essentially over at that point. But he is saying or said at that time that he suffered reputational damage. The company didn't recover and was eventually taken over. And so he's seeking damages. He's just about to get into court for that. Why 25 years? How come it takes so long?
It's astonishingly like Bleak House. It's an American Bleak House. The case went to the Supreme Court, and it resulted in a decision specifically on the context of who has the burden of proof in these cases. And Mr. Moore remains having the burden of proof to prove that his constitutional rights were the cause of why the prosecution was brought. But the case has been up to the Court of Appeals 6 times. In 25 years. And I'd like to read you a quote, Tom. There's a remarkable quote here from one of the judges on the Court of Appeals. He says, I write separately to express dismay over the Herculean effort the plaintiff had to expend simply to get his day in court. It has taken 25 years to get to the point where a jury will hear and decide if the government engaged in payback because of what he did. To say that this has not been the government's finest hour is a colossal and lamentable understatement. That's one of the judges on the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals also said the evidence of retaliatory motive in the case comes close to, quote, a proverbial smoking gun. So that's why the case has persisted, and it's actually in trial now as a civil case against the postal inspectors, but not against the prosecutor. The case was dismissed against the prosecutor who brought the unsuccessful case, finding that essentially the decisions of prosecutors here will not be second-guessed by courts, that there's almost a complete immunity unless the prosecutor runs from the courtroom screaming, I did it in retaliation for his constitutional rights being exercised.
So what is the lesson say for the government in this case? I mean, having been a prosecutor?
So, you know, I think the interesting aspect of this is that investigators and prosecutors in the federal government sometimes step over the line. And most times they do not, but sometimes they do. And when they do, generally they get away with it because no one does what Mr. Moore has done, which is to come back at them after getting out of his own criminal case and reverse the tables and bring it. You have to have someone with millions of dollars and with a steel lining in his stomach who's willing to make such a fight. And I think here's what it means for federal officials generally who are in the investigative area, you know, all of the position description 1811 gun-toting agents in the government, which is at the end of the day, there are limits on what you can do. There are limits on how you can act. And, you know, if you run up against the wrong guy, you might someday be called to explain all of that. And so it's a cautionary tale for federal officials in the investigative area. On the other hand, I have to say this is about as rare, an event as you could possibly imagine. So it isn't going to be a run-of-the-mill event. It is a very unusual event to have this kind of a case.
We're speaking with Steve Ryan. He's a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery. And we should point out, I guess, that Bill Moore is no crank. I mean, this is a man who was decorated Vietnam veteran. He was in the Army Rangers. He was a big success at Trammell Crow, the real estate company here in Washington. And then he built this company out of almost nothing at that time, REI, the Recognition Equipment Incorporated, and was even on President Reagan's Advisory Committee for Trade Negotiations. So I guess they did pick the wrong guy in this case. But what does this say about how costly this has to be? I guess my question really is, how often or do prosecutors, do they get personally involved in a case, or is it just a day's work for them in general?
Well, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia where I worked, you know, we had a constant supply of criminals, and we tended not to get deeply involved in cases unless they were these kind of white-collar, very complex cases. When that kind of case is there, by nature, you have to get deeply involved in the case. I didn't know the assistant who had this case, but I was in the office almost at the same time. And so, you know, I think it is a cautionary tale. When you go up against people, you have to, I think, also as a prosecutor, think about what the agents have told you, because agents have spent 3 or 4 years sometimes working on a case. They're vested in it. And you have to provide the judgment then to decide whether what they've put together is really compelling, that a crime has occurred, that a wrong has occurred. And even if technically a crime has occurred, do you really need to bring this case versus all of the other cases that are in front of you? It's a question of discretion. And in this case, obviously, that discretion might not have been exercised. But let me say something about the procurement aspect of this. I think this is another fascinating aspect of this, because Mr. Moore essentially had a procurement goal that he was trying to achieve, and he achieved it in some ways by trying to reposition his company, by choosing the leader of the government agency that was going to choose the product. It's a fascinating tale of trying to get around a procurement shop that he believed was locking out an American company in favor of a foreign company and a foreign technology instead of a U.S. technology. That latter issue is the kind of issue that is recurrent, where the procurement shop sometimes seems unresponsive and has a strategy that they're not going to come off of. And Mr. Moore essentially circumvented that in part by his dynamic activity in trying to help choose a new leader for the agency.
Although he's not the first, well, yeah, that's going a little bit further than most companies, which might use their, if they're big enough, some of the big companies would have a lobbying arm that's on, you know, K Street instead of in Reston or wherever the technology shop is, and try to work the agency in some other manner. But getting to that level, the secretarial level, if you will,
yes,
that's unusual.
It is unusual, but I think it is consistent, by the way, with the frustration that occurs in the business community with what they perceive as a lockout by the procurement office. And so, you know, what this is a tale of procurement and of government officials allegedly being stepping over the line with regard to using their investigatory authority to retaliate for that exercise of the First Amendment. So it is going to be a relatively rare case, Tom.
And at first I thought this might be like the Ted Stevens case, where there was a conviction that was later thrown out, but it really never even got to the conviction, or it was just acquitted beforehand.
Well, it's even worse than that. I mean, it's embarrassing when you're in the government and the case is thrown out by the judge and doesn't even get to the jury. What the judge has said there is no reasonable jury could find this. And most judges actually reserve that authority. They have that authority but can reserve it and sometimes let the case go to the jury. And if the jury gets it wrong, they then correct it. But in this case, it was an embarrassing failure of the prosecution, which can happen, and there but for the grace of God go some of the rest of us. But in this case, you know, it's 25 years later, people are going to be exploring what the motivations were for people then. Most of us can't remember what happened 25 days ago or 25 months ago, but to consider that you're going to go back 25 years is also, I think, an extraordinary legal activity and a reflection of a process that's spun out of control in this case.
And he's asking for $235 million in damages now, so we'll see how that comes out too, I guess. Steve Ryan is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery. Steve, always good talking with you.
Tom, thank you, and thanks for having me on.